Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we have a full hour of news stories from across the world to bring you back to Earth after the 4th of July weekend. We hope yours was a happy one. But we're going to begin with a healthcare story that is very familiar, but we will add some facts you may never have heard before. First, imagine being told you have breast cancer.
I was upset for a minute, but even though 99% of you says the test is going to be negative, but there's that 1% that said, just in case, you better get ready.
Then imagine as you absorb the implications of that very personal revelation, imagine realizing that you are in a group of women whose chance of surviving breast cancer has not improved at the same pace as high-tech detection and cancer treatment over the past 30 years. Today, doctors find a widening dividing line between black women and white women diagnosed with breast cancer. The line is the survival line. One recent study found that African-American women are on average 40% more likely to die of breast cancer than their white counterparts. With those statistics in mind, we're going to get under the skin here. It's the title of our series starting this week, Under Her Skin, Living with Breast Cancer. Over the next 6 months, three African-American women living with the disease will share their stories with us about treatment, family, jobs, home. They'll share some intimate details about how they made decisions to get surgeries that will forever alter their bodies. They'll tell us what it's like to be young and single and trying to date while diagnosed with cancer. They'll tell us about what it's like to lose their hair. Through audio diaries, we'll be following their stories for the next 6 months. We begin, as all patients do in this situation, with questions for a doctor. Kathy Ann Joseph is an assistant professor of surgery and director of breast services at Bellevue Hospital and NYU Langone Medical Center. Our first question for her is why this disparity exists between black and white women.
There was always a disparity. And the problem is that the disparity has persisted and it's actually widening. And that's the conundrum. And initially, we thought that the disparity was due to the fact that African-American women had not had the access to screening mammographies. But it's been 20 years, 30 years. And this disparity still persists.
What would be the impediments towards access? Is it information? Is it education? Is it some sort of socioeconomic insurance kind of issue?
All of the above. Yes, I do believe that. I think that for many women, it's lack of education and knowing if they don't have insurance, they may feel that they can't get a mammogram in certain areas. I know I'm in New York, so there is the ability to get free screening even if you don't have insurance and no questions asked whether you're undocumented or not. And by the way, and if you are diagnosed, you can get coverage for your treatment all the way through. And then there's the concern for many women who have families and who work and how are they going to, they're thinking down the line about how am I going to handle all of this. And then it may all snowball in a woman's head as to, you know what, I'd rather not even deal with that. So I'm not going to go get that mammogram.
You know, we talked with someone young, couldn't be more knowledgeable, mm-hmm. Couldn't be more like obsessed with like the inputs she puts into her body, you know, in terms of like best kind of diet, best kind of healthy food. I mean, she's not messing around in any way whatsoever. And she's diagnosed and she's really scared by these statistics. Has there been any study done of inputs, behavioral inputs, dietary issues that would point the way?
We do know that there are certain measures that women can take to reduce their risk. And we know that there are certain health conditions in the African-American community that we need to work on as a group, like obesity, hypertension, the whole cardiac risk factors. And we know that women who are overweight or obese have a higher risk of developing breast cancer. So that's one issue that we need to work on, physical activity. We know that women who have breast cancer but are physically active do better. What I tell women when I go out into the community, because I do a lot of community outreach, is that breast cancer, if it's caught early, it's very treatable.
So. You know, we got this crazy statistic here that Memphis is the deadliest major American city for African-American women with breast cancer. Why would that be?
I can only speculate that there may need to be some more outreach in that community and other cities like Memphis. I mean, what helps reduce the mortality rates is not just having hospitals that can provide the care. Any hospital can have a doctor that can do the operation and the chemotherapy. You have to get the patient in. And you also have to provide the support. Breast cancer is one of these cancers that really, truly requires multidisciplinary support. You're not just treating the patient. You're treating all the issues that come with the patient. And if you're dealing with an underserved population, you may also need to be able to provide that patient with social work. Maybe a legal team that may be able to help them with maybe eviction or domestic abuse, psychological support. They're not going to come in and just say right out to you, doc, I need a psychologist, or I need to talk to someone because I'm depressed or I feel inadequate because I had a mastectomy. All of these things will play a role, and they may not be able to articulate that to you right out front. They may be embarrassed.
Well, I'm sure your voice will be very helpful to our friends that we're on this journey with. Dr. Joseph, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
Dr. Kathy Ann Joseph is an assistant professor of surgery and director of breast services at Bellevue Hospital and NYU Langone Medical Center. So with all that in mind, what's the first thing I'm going to notice if I meet the first woman in our series, Lisa Eccles from Memphis, Tennessee, face to face?
You would notice my smile. And notice that I speak to everybody.
Lisa sees patients every day. That's her job as a 46-year-old technician at Baptist Memorial Hospital for Women. But perhaps her favorite place is right at home at her kitchen table.
Even at home, I'm right there in the kitchen to either pour you a cup of coffee or ask you, do you want a second cup? And if you saw me, even to this day, you would not look at me in that manner. At all.
Lisa Eccles was diagnosed with breast cancer just before Christmas of last year, December 9th, 2013. Because she works in a hospital, she knew a little how to respond.
Your tumor is the size of a quarter. I'm thinking you between stage one and stage two. We can remove the tumor or we can remove the whole breast.
We sat down with Lisa as she was making her decision. She eventually decided to have a bilateral mastectomy, a surgery that would ultimately remove both breasts. Lisa says she definitely doesn't feel like she has a big C sign painted on her these days. In fact, she says it's all day-to-day right now.
I don't consider it a C. I consider it a T, which stands for a test for me. We all go through tests in life, and this is my test. And at the end of passing my test, I will have a story to tell somebody.
Well, you can start me at the beginning of your story. When did you get a hint that something was maybe going wrong here?
Well, I'm so good with myself, trying to be healthy. And my husband, who is a diabetic, when he was diagnosed, I got in gear as far as eating right, exercising, and going on doctor's appointments. Because I know that men don't like to go to see about themselves when it comes to doctors. So what we decided to do is to do it as a couple. So I will make an appointment along with him. So I already knew that in November, it was time for me to get my mammogram. This is when I found out on December the 9th, 2013, that I had the big C. I was shocked. Devastated, because I knew that in the back of my mind, I was doing all the right stuff. So, like I said, it was hard for me because at that point, I wanted to know, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? That was my biggest concern. Where did I go wrong at?
But Lisa, you can't blame yourself. I mean, this wasn't something you did.
No, it wasn't. But those thoughts come in your mind when you
right.
first hear it, because you're trying to figure out the puzzle. But after settling down, I realized that it wasn't for me to figure out.
So how did you tell your husband? How did you tell your kids? I mean, What's that like?
As soon as I walked out of the doctor's office, I told my husband what they had said, and he took it very well. And as far as my children, I didn't tell them until the biopsy came back. I told my husband to just act as normal and wait on the results before we set the children down to tell them. And the biggest part for me, and the hardest part for me, was telling my daughter, who lives in Nashville, and she just had left from being at home for Thanksgiving. She wanted to come home, and I said, no, I'm okay, and I'm going to be okay. And at that particular time, after almost finishing up the conversation with her, I said, I don't have time to talk to you. I have to polish my toenails and continue to look pretty as I go through this test. And so we kind of laughed it off. And from there, I hung up the phone. But telling my son here, who's still living at home, his biggest thing was, Mom, are you in any pain? And I said, no. And from there, he said, are you going to lose your hair? And I said, I'm going to be as bald as you are.
So bald on top, but the finest toenails in the oncology unit.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So you had some decisions to make, right?
I did. I did. I had a lot of decisions to make. And when you've been handed the C, it's like your life moves really fast. Because after the diagnosis, they immediately send you to see a surgeon. Then you immediately go to see the oncology doctor, and he immediately wants to start the treatment. So it was a lot of doctor visits. I've decided that I was going to have a bilateral mastectomy, which is removing both breasts and doing reconstruction.
Well, Lisa, I can't tell you how great it is to meet you and to spend some time with you, and it's going to be great going on this journey with you if you'll let us.
When I was first told about doing this program with y'all, I was at work that particular day, and I was talking to the Lord, and I said, if this is what you want me to go through, I'll go through it, but use me to help somebody else. I'll do whatever if I can save somebody else, because there are so many African American women that do not take care of themselves or go to get checked out. If it happened to me, it can happen to somebody else.
Lisa Eccles, 46-year-old hospital technician from Memphis, Tennessee. Her story is one we will be following for the next 6 months. For an extended version of our conversation with Lisa and to hear her audio diary, visit us at thetakeaway.org/series/breast cancer. We want to invite everyone to take part in this exploration of breast cancer and what it's like to live with the disease. We started a Facebook group, and we'd love for you to join. Go to facebook.com and type in Under Her Skin to find us. There you can share your stories, post pictures, take part in our ongoing conversation about the trials and triumphs living with breast cancer. Again, type the phrase Under Her Skin on Facebook. We'll have lots more there. We take you now to a very tense Middle East. The deaths of three Israeli teenage hikers last month, their attackers unknown, but in a crime officially blamed on followers of the Hamas organization, have been answered with a vigilante-styled killing of a Palestinian teenager. Six Jewish males have been arrested in the case, and three of them have confessed to the crime of burning the 16-year-old Palestinian alive near his home in East Jerusalem last week and dumping him in a nearby forest. On Sunday, Tariq Kadir, a cousin of the murdered teen who lives in Florida and was visiting Palestine on a summer vacation, was released from jail after being beaten to the point of unconsciousness by Israeli border police officers for allegedly throwing stones at them. The beating was caught on videotape. Tariq Kadir denies he was involved in any protest. Two views on the tensions from all of this. First, Mark Regev, spokesman for the Israeli government, Earlier, I asked Mr. Regev for his reaction to the apparent beating of Tariq Kadir by the Israeli border police.
Well, thankfully, Israel is a country where there's rule of law, and no one is above the law, not the police, not the security services, no one. And so there is an independent external investigation underway as to those charges. We don't have a situation in Israel where the police investigate themselves. And if there was wrongdoing, we can't jump the gun, but if there was wrongdoing, if the video is in fact genuine and we see police officers beating up a handcuffed suspect, that is totally unacceptable, and there will be a price to be paid. But we have to wait, of course, for the legal process to follow through.
Well, there is a videotape.
Once again. And that videotape is prime evidence in this investigation. But once again, the legal process cannot be, it can't be a kangaroo court. We have to go through the correct legal process. The officers involved have the right to make their defense, and we'll pursue this to the full depth of the law.
What high-level talks do you think are called for at this moment between members of the Palestinian Authority, possible authority figures that are appropriate to speak to? I don't know, even know who I would put down as a name here in Gaza to keep the lid on this situation here with the Israeli government.
I think we've shown over the last 24 hours how furious we are against fighting racism, against fighting hate crimes, against fighting vigilante violence. I mean, we've arrested these people, and the Prime Minister has used extremely harsh language in describing this phenomenon. He says there's no room for such behavior in our society, no room whatsoever. And he says murder is murder. It doesn't matter who is the perpetrator or who is the victim. Murder is murder. Terrorism is terrorism. We will not tolerate that. I think it's time that the Palestinian side came forth with a similar statement. We'd like to hear from them an unequivocal condemnation of the murders of the Jewish teens. We'd like to hear an end to the calls for violence and rioting. Ultimately, Israel's a democracy. Everyone can have an opinion. Everyone can debate. But you can't have a situation where people are throwing stones and Molotov cocktails at motorists.
I hear what you're saying. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time with the IDF. I've spent a lot of time in your office, Mark. I mean, look around your neighborhood. I mean, time may be running out here a little bit. Are you sure you got the lid on this?
I'm not sure. The neighborhood's going through a particularly violent and tumultuous period. I mean, and this is, I think, important to understand. The killers of the three Israeli teens who were kidnapped and murdered, they are from the Hamas organization. And for want of a better word, and maybe you can think of a better word, Hamas is part of a family of organizations. There's ISIS in Iraq and Syria. There's Hezbollah in Lebanon. There's Boko Haram in Nigeria. You've got a whole bunch of these extremist Islamic groups that basically say that human life is worthless, that they say kidnapping and murder is fine, anything that advances their radical agenda. And it is troubling that we see this upsurge in this sort of extremism throughout the region. And I think all the forces that want peace and stability and moderation have to be embraced, and we have to work together to overcome the extremists.
But is implicit in what you're saying there very eloquently, possibly that the military machine of the IDF might not be a defense against that extremism?
Unfortunately, you have no substitute for the IDF and no substitute for the Israeli police, because the Israeli public is under attack by these vicious terrorists. You know, Hamas says openly, you don't need Mark Regev to say it, Hamas says openly that the Jewish state has no right to exist, not in any borders. Hamas says openly that every Israeli civilian, man and woman, and as we saw last week, children as well, are legitimate targets in their war of terror. So we need to defend ourselves in this difficult situation. At the same time, we have to hold out our hand and see, can we find partners, can we find moderates on the other side who disavow the path of the extremists, who disavow and condemn the path of the terrorists, and we can work with them to build a better future.
Well, here's hoping that some high-level talks and something, at least with some symbolic value, can get going in the next 24 to 36 hours. Mark Regev, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure, sir.
Mark Regev is spokesman for the Israeli government. He joined us from Tel Aviv. We turn now to Fawez Jerjez, professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and author of The New Middle East, Protest and Revolution in the Arab World. Fawaz, we've just heard from Mark Regev. He compares Hamas to the other extremist groups like ISIS and Boko Haram. What do you make of that?
It's basically nonsense. Hamas is not either the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Hamas is not Al-Qaeda. Hamas is an Islamist resistance movement. It has come a long way. It now acknowledges basically that a two-state solution is the only way to go. Hamas is a nationalist religious movement as opposed to being a Salafi jihadist movement. It does not have any global aspirations. Its only aspiration is to basically help bring about liberation and self-determination for the Palestinian people, in particular as it has evolved since 2006.
Although, as we have seen in Iraq and in Syria, there are players who have an interest in fomenting instability, and the instability in Syria begat the instability in Iraq. And there's certainly a lot of people who might love to see a, Aleppo in Haifa.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, if the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gambles on the fact that the region is imploding, that there are civil wars taking place in Syria and Iraq, that he can maintain occupation as it is, that he can steal Palestinian land, that he can create facts on the ground, I think he lives in Wonderland. The situation is very precarious, very fragile, and unless the Palestinians and the Israelis sit down and find a way to resolve their differences, unless the Israelis begin the process of acknowledging that basically their military occupation of Palestinian land must end, I think the situation could easily spiral out of control and bring about further escalation and all-out war in the region.
Fawaz, we've just heard from Mark Regev. He compares Hamas to the other extremist groups like ISIS and Boko Haram. What do you make of that?
You know, John, I'm surprised you ask me, what can Israel do? President Barack Obama, when he first came to office, made it very clear that the first most important step, basically, for Israel to do is to stop stealing Palestinian land.
Okay, all right. Let's not use inflammatory language here. So if Benjamin Netanyahu said today the settlements have stopped, no more settlements in the West Bank and Gaza, this would be a first step in your view?
Absolutely. An essential step. How do you begin the process of establishing a two-state solution, of giving hope to the Palestinians, convincing the Palestinians that Israel does not create facts on the ground, that there is the possibility of a viable, independent Palestinian state while you build basically settlements on occupied Palestinian territories, both in East Jerusalem and on the West Bank?
All right. So number one, the settlements stop on this particular date, and we will begin talks to make that happen. That's number one. What's number two?
Basically, the borders of the Israeli and Palestinian states. This is the second most important step. Israel so far, under the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, has refused to delineate what the borders of Israel are and what the borders of a Palestinian state are. We know what the borders are. The borders of a future Palestinian state is on all of the occupied West Bank and Gaza and occupied East Jerusalem. The entire world, including the United States itself, believes this is the way to go. Two independent, viable, secure states living side by side.
All right, so Fawaz, let's just talk practically here. We know the Israelis aren't going to give a specific full border. They're going to say that really requires negotiation, et cetera. But if it was something like, all right, we'll swap the settlements closest to Tel Aviv for secure borders in the Golan, around Nablus, and to the south along the Gaza Strip, that would be a first step as far as you're concerned.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the big point, John, we keep going around the circle here. The reality is, and yes, probably I'm using direct, blunt language, while Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu pays lip service to a two-state solution, he has no interest in an independent, viable Palestinian state, as it's seen by the entire world, including the United States of America. I'm not saying anything original here. Ask President Barack Obama, his former Secretary of State, I mean Hillary Clinton, and John Kerry. They would tell you exactly that it's not as the spokesperson of the Israeli government has just said. It's not that the Israelis don't have a partner. The reality is the Palestinians don't have a partner for peace with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at this particular moment.
Do you think the lid's going to stay on here in the Palestinian territories and in Israel?
You know, I can't tell you, John, how much the Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas is trying to convince Palestinians in West Bank towns and cities and trying to suppress protests. There's a great deal of anger and restiveness and hopelessness on the part of the Palestinians in West Bank cities and towns, not just Gaza, and even Arab Israelis. And that's why the situation could really easily spiral out of control. We have the making of a third intifada. I hope it does not happen. I hope that President Barack Obama takes the initiative and tries to bring about some calm and quiet and basically beginning the process of building a two-state solution in what we call Israel-Palestine.
Fawaz Jerjes, professor of international relations at the London School of Economics, author of The New Middle East, Protest and Revolution in the Arab World. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, John.
A familiar underwater voice here, perhaps?
Today marks the end of the third year of our expedition. Faithful Calypso has carried us nearly 140,000 nautical miles. And the divers have spent the one-man equivalent of 14 months in the depth. Yet we go on, farther and deeper in the sea.
For years, the name Jacques Cousteau was underwater exploration. This film clip comes from the 1960s and 70s, but Cousteau speaks from the headlines of today.
There is a fresh sense of urgency in our work, observing and reporting on the awesome alchemy of the sea.
Jacques Cousteau's decades-long exploration and elegy to the sea he loved was a television phenomenon. And Jacques Cousteau's grandson, Fabien Cousteau, has just wrapped up his own record-breaking underwater expedition called Mission 31. For 31 days, Cousteau and his team lived and worked about 60 feet underwater aboard the world's only undersea laboratory, the Aquarius Reef Base in the Florida Keys. This kind of exploring in an underwater laboratory was pioneered by Grandpa Jacques 50 years ago in the Red Sea. Sending humans to study the ocean in this way is something WGBH science editor Heather Goldstone got to experience firsthand on her own, frankly, mind-blowing trip to Mission 31.
Aquarius is basically a hyperbaric chamber, but it's like a long metal oblong tube. It's about 43 feet long and 9 feet in diameter, so it's not huge on the inside. And they basically sank it full of air, and so to get into it, you put on your scuba tanks, you dive down to 60 feet, you duck under this little overhang at one end of Aquarius, and then when you stand up, you're actually standing up into air about thigh deep or knee deep in water, and then standing in air, and you can look out windows. You go up a few stairs onto like a little porch, and you can look out windows and be watching the ocean around you, and it's completely surreal to know
cool.
That you're underwater, but that you're standing in air. And I can only imagine what that experience is like for days or weeks for the aquanauts who were living down there. It was really pretty amazing just for the few minutes that I was down there.
In this particular environment down there, you know, how do you respond to things like sleep and metabolism, and how do the aquanauts interact with each other to make sure that they're all going to survive?
Well, first of all, there's this 10 hours of dive time limitation, but that doesn't seem like much of a limit. That could be pretty exhausting, especially when you consider the fact that even though it's tropical water, it's still below body temperature. It's constantly sucking heat out of your body, and they're burning 400 to 500 extra calories every hour just trying to keep their body temperature up. I mean, it's a huge, huge metabolic load. They're constantly eating M&Ms and fatty snacks, and one of the aquanauts told me that she'd been eating these. They mostly eat freeze-dried food like astronauts do, and she'd been eating this freeze-dried food called breakfast skillets that's basically every breakfast food, the hash browns and the sausage and the eggs and the toast and everything all mixed together. And near the end of the mission, she actually looked at the nutrition facts on the back and was appalled at the calories and fat. And she'd been eating two or three of these a day just because that's what your body needs. And they're also, as a result, as you can imagine, prone to just falling asleep at the drop of a hat.
You can instantly fall asleep sitting up. I mean, within 30 seconds, I've seen people go out. And that, of course, is a green light for all of your narked fellow aquanauts to use you in whatever performance art they want to cook up in terms of posing things on your head or on your shoulders.
He mentions there the fact that being narked. So two other things there. First of all, you've got a little bit of cabin fever going on, right? You've got 400 square feet of space inside this habitat, inside Aquarius, and six people living in that. It's really tight quarters. So there's a lot of kind of joking and that kind of fun that goes on to make sure that relations don't get too tense. But then there's also the fact that when you have your blood saturated with nitrogen, there's something that happens called nitrogen narcosis, which basically means that maybe a little giddy, maybe a little euphoric. Some people actually get a little bit paranoid. It kind of plays with your mind and your judgment. And so everything can seem a little extra funny when you're down there as well.
So scientifically speaking, what's the advantage of studying the ocean environment using this kind of a technique?
Well, I'd say there are two things. There's an aspect of Aquarius that is not just the research, and it goes even beyond education. I'd call it inspiration. And Aquarius is connected to the internet all the time. They're doing these live talks and Google Hangouts and all sorts of stuff. And so people can actually see them living down there. And there's something really incredible about the amount of inspiration and excitement that can generate that nothing else can really match. But then there's also the fact that when you've got 10 hours a day on the reef, as opposed to with three dives a day on scuba, maybe 2 hours on the bottom, the science you can do is that much more intricate. You can do that much more. I mean, they say they probably gathered a year's worth of data in 2 weeks with the Aquanauts down there. And then in addition, you can just slow down and look around. It's something that the Aquanauts call the gift of time, where they can really just look around them, make detailed observations of things that you just wouldn't have time to do when you're down there trying to use every second of your bottom time on scuba to get one experiment done.
And some of those detailed observations over a very, very long time horizon, which is permitted by this environment in Aquarius, tells a pretty sad story, as you learned during your reporting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Aquarius has been involved in something like 600 research papers over the 100-odd missions that have been conducted there and are really giving scientists a detailed understanding. In particular, the Northeastern researchers that I was following and a lot of the research over the years has been looking at the detailed physiology of corals and of sponges, of reef organisms, and how they are responding to the myriad threats that they face at this point. It's pollutants and silt and nutrients running off of the land from development. It's overfishing and overuse of the reefs for recreation. And now, of course, the impacts of climate change, rising water temperatures, changing ocean chemistry. All that comes together in a pretty sad way. And I spoke with Mark Patterson. He's a professor at Northeastern University who's been working with Aquarius since 1984. And he says that the changes that he's watched in Caribbean coral reefs are really dramatic.
It's like watching a train crash in slow motion. And when you look at the landscape, it's like looking at an overgrown mossy city, like something out of one of these apocalyptic movies you see in the theater, where you see the corals that used to be there, and in your mind's eye you just blur your eyes and imagine them all alive, and then you open your eyes and see they're all covered in algae and that they're dead.
That is so sad. And I mean, he's really describing an environment that for him is a supreme joy, but it tells a story that is a real tragedy on Earth.
Mark Patterson is a very jovial person, and when we talked about this, he said it makes him borderline depressed to even think about it.
And in your life experience, there's probably no price to be put on that first view you got looking out of Aquarius.
Definitely not, and I think every Aquanaut who's been down there would tell you the same thing. There's nothing like it, and everyone who has spent time in Aquarius says that they just can't wait for their next chance to do it again.
Better than Nemo.
Definitely better than Nemo.
Heather Goldstone, WGBH Science Editor, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And thanks to our partner WGBH for allowing us to take a nice cool dip in the Florida Keys. And earlier this hour, we were introduced to Lisa Eccles, a 46-year-old hospital technician from Memphis, Tennessee, diagnosed with breast cancer in December of 2013 upon receiving her yearly mammogram.
I wanted to know, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? That was my biggest concern. Where did I go wrong at?
You can hear more of Lisa's story by going to thetakeaway.org/series/breast cancer. We want you to be a part of all these conversations. Share your stories, your reactions, and what it is like to live with breast cancer. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Join the Facebook group we've just started. Go to facebook.com and type in Under Her Skin to find us. Lots more there. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.